Hey everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and we got a great show lined up for you today. First will be Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute to talk about why capitalism is good and government is evil. And in the second hour, we're going to be talking to Dar Jamel. He writes for Antiwar.com and Interpress Service, and he's an American from Alaska who has gone to Iraq to report what he sees as the truth of what's going on there, which is quite a bit different than the Fox News version of what's happening. So we will be talking in the second hour, 1 hour from now, 4 p.m. Central Time, to Dar Jamel live from Baghdad. So stay tuned for that. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com if anybody wants to look or listen to any of the archives of previous interviews, weekendinterviewshow.com. And let's go ahead and bring on Mark Thornton. He is an economist and a senior fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute for Austrian Economics and is the author of the book, The Economics of Prohibition, and is co-author of Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War. He is also the book review editor for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's great to be here with you.
Well, it's good to have you on. What the heck is Austrian economics?
Well, Austrian economics is a school of economic thought that was founded in Austria, in Vienna, in 1871. And in modern version, it's really an American school of economic thought. It stresses the importance of a society based on private property, sound money, and a free market economy. And it was a very small school of economic thought, very much against the mainstream of economic thought, but we're growing and we're becoming more popular on college campuses and financial press every year.
Well, when you say private property rights and free markets, that sounds just like what ought to be called the American school of economics, no?
Well, that's true.
Seems kind of funny that it would have to be invented in Austria and imported here.
Well, it was actually run out of Austria by Hitler and during World War II, and the Austrians like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek fled Austria at the time and migrated to the United States and found jobs here in the United States. But the odd thing was is that at the time, of course, the economics world was being captured by Keynesian economics out of England, which is very much a statist, pro-government, pro-government debt, pro-inflation form of school of economics. And that school of economics actually came to dominate the American academic scene in terms of economics and is still dominant at the American universities, the central bank, and all of the governmental agencies. That school is still, unfortunately, dominant and controls basically economic thought and economic teachings. We're very much running counter to all of that.
Well, and you have your work cut out for you because I think a common characterization of America today, and maybe this is just because I live in Austin, Texas, but a common characterization is that the corruption of our culture and our government is the fault of capitalism. It's the billionaire's greed for that almighty dollar that has driven this country to become an empire.
Well, that's a big charge right there, no doubt about it. The statist form of economics does control the profession, and the profession controls people's minds and people's ideas, and that, of course, filters down into the media and into textbooks and everything else. The idea that capitalism is the thing that is corrupting society, whereas the exact opposite is really the truth. Capitalism is a way of keeping society in check and in control.
All right, we'll be right back.
In the right direction.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and our guest this hour is Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute for Austrian Economics. And when we went out to the break, we were talking about the conflict between Mises and the Austrian school of thought versus John Maynard Keynes and the Keynesian school of government intervention in the economy. And
yes.
Go ahead.
Let's take a look at those greedy capitalists, because, I mean, the Austrian school says those capitalists are indeed greedy. And let's take a look at the case of Enron right in your backyard, where you've got some greedy capitalists who had gone outside the normal channels and had really done some funny financing and some corrupt practices. Now, Enron is a company that is regulated by the government at so many levels, I can't even count them all. The local, certainly the state, as a public utility, they're constantly regulated. The Securities and Exchange Commission, so on and so forth.
Well,
are the ones that are supposed to be keeping track of Enron and its practices, and they never turned up anything. And yet one little greedy guy who was an analyst, all of a sudden he said, hey, there's something wrong here. And look what happens. The market cleaned up the problem of Enron in a matter of weeks, where the company was, the stock price was sent to zero. The company was bankrupted, put out of business. All of those people lost their jobs.
But that's not an argument for that the regulators should do a better job.
Well, I mean, we've had so many different levels of regulation on Enron. Enron was one of the most regulated types of companies in the entire planet, basically. And so you certainly can't say regulation worked in that case, but you can say that one guy who was out to make a buck and who analyzed the company and its books that threw up a red flag or a yellow flag and said, this isn't working here, and the marketplace fixed that situation in a matter of a couple of months, and all of those people at the top lost money, they lost their jobs. The company itself, of course, was still in business in different forms. The employees didn't really lose their jobs. The customers didn't lose their service. And now the government has been stretching on the trials, trying to see who is the scapegoat in this for a year or two or more, and has come up with little or nothing. The market actually cleaned up that situation very quickly, even though it was the government's job at the Securities and Exchange Commission, the state regulators, and so forth. They didn't do their job. They were actually the ones who were providing special favors for Enron and giving them special exemptions. So it was government, really, that was at the heart of the failure of a company like Enron, whereas the marketplace and the little guy in this case, this one little guy who uncovered the whole story, was really responsible for fixing the whole thing.
Well, but you know what they say, when you let capitalism run wild with no regulation, you get the Great Depression.
Well, the Austrians view the Great Depression and business cycles in an entirely different light. Everybody, from the mainstream media to the mainstream economics, economists view depressions and business cycles as an unforeseen happening where we were going along just perfectly well, and for no reason at all, the marketplace just failed. Well, it just so happens that the Austrians have a very good theory of why economies go in cycles and why there are great depressions. And basically what we have shown is that the central bank, in this case the Federal Reserve System, is setting a price control on the interest rate. One of the worst things you could possibly do, but that's what they do, is they control the interest rate. And they don't really know what the interest rate should be. And so very often they charge too low of a rate. Sometimes they charge too high of a rate. And it's that mistake that they constantly make in the interest rate that causes the Great Depression. And so one of the studies that I've done is I've gone back through the entire 20th century. I've looked at the Great Depression. I've looked at the stagflation of the 1970s, the Japanese bubble, and our own stock market bubble in the 1990s. In each four of those cases, what I found is that Austrian economists have been right there, right before the crash, saying the central bank is causing a bubble in the stock market, it's causing a boom in the economy, and eventually that bubble is going to bust, and eventually the economy is going to suffer a severe recession as a consequence. At the same time, mainstream economists are saying, everything's fine. We're going to have perpetual prosperity. We've fixed the economy. We've killed off the business cycle. And the evidence indicates that the Austrians were right all four times, and that the mainstream, and I'm talking about the leading mainstream economists, got it wrong all four times.
And they're the ones, of course, who call for more government intervention when their perfect situation comes to its failure.
Oh, yeah, and that, you know, they always make it worse. And then the Great Depression is a very good case, because the Great Depression didn't have to be as great, didn't have to be as horrific and long-lived as it actually was. But, of course, what we got was, the response was, instead of allowing the economy to fix itself, what they did was went in with massive government intervention, with a central bank pumping up the money supply, with government spending programs, and, of course, during the 1930s, it was the New Deal, all sorts of new regulations, all sorts of new restrictions, constraints on foreign trade, constraints on wage rate changes, labor law regulations, and that all perpetuated the Great Depression. In the 1970s, we saw the same thing. We had wage and price controls. We had controls on oil prices. We went off the gold standard.
And that was Richard Nixon, the Republican.
Yeah. Well, the Republicans actually are there for most of the big economic calamities. You think of them as a pro-business party or a pro-market economy, but they're basically a pro-special interest group economy. They're not really pro-business in a more general sense.
It seems like if they were really for capitalism, they would have the Libertarian Party would have raised more than $1 million in this last campaign, right?
Well, that's right. The Libertarian Party, they can't get any money because they don't appeal to any special interest groups. They're not out giving away favors to anybody. They're just trying to take government off of the board and take away the gravy train of special interests. So those poor people, they don't get any of those kind of contributions. They only get, you know, ideological dollars. And that's not enough to go up against corporate America and the public employees unions and, you know, all the special interest groups across the board. They just don't stand a chance because they're not doling out gravy from the federal government.
Well, when the policymakers are discussing or debating demand-side or supply-side economics, and I guess like during the 80s, the monetarists, Milton Friedman and all them, and the supply side, is supply side not just sort of right Keynesianism? Is that not supply and demand side both part of Keynesian socialist theory?
Well, yes, they are. I mean, they both come from the same professional framework of analysis. And so there is a lot of similarities between Keynesians, monetarists, and supply-siders from the perspective of the Austrian school, which is so much different. Now, I have to admit that I have more sympathy for the supply side point of view, because at least they're showing some concern for the productive economy, whereas the Keynesians show no concern for the productive economy. They more or less want to continually flow more and more resources to the government side of the economy, sometimes called the destructive side of the economy. So I have a little more sympathy for the supply-siders, but then ultimately the supply-siders are disappointing in the sense that they want a more productive economy so they can siphon off more money into the government. And they do some silly things in terms of what we think of in terms of monetary policy. So I'd say they're a little bit better, but they come from the same scope of analysis. And so ultimately they're disappointing from an Austrian point of view.
In the book Secrets of the Temple by former Washington Post editor William Grierder, he writes, the book is mostly about the term of Fed Chairman Paul Volcker during the 1980s and his war on inflation. And the way William Grierder describes it is, even though it was called supply side, the money that the rich were saving in tax cuts and that they were making in high interest rates was not going into investing in new supply that would then employ people and all that kind of deal. But in fact, it was really demand side economics for the rich. If you sold Porsches for a living, you did a lot better. But that the money was not being invested in new supply. There was plenty of supply. And so what it was really was demand side to put cash in the pockets of rich people to buy fine art and fast cars.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one of the things that we've seen in our economy really over the last two decades is that at the central bank, the policies have been such that instead of helping the little guy, instead of helping small business, is that they have been geared more towards the protection and the interests of big business, big banking, big corporations, controlling interest rates and controlling capital flows and preventing systemic risk in the economy from affecting these big corporations has ultimately been to the advantage of the big guy and to the detriment of the small guy. And so we've seen an unbalancing in our economy over the last 30 years. And ultimately, Austrians see that unbalancing as directly related to going off the gold standard in 1971, which freed the hands of the central bank to perpetuate ill-founded monetary policy. And that ill-founded monetary policy is really gutting the capital of this country, but favoring the big guy over the small guy.
All right, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Mises.org. We'll be right back. Alright, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest this hour is Mark Thornton, and he's from the Ludwig von Mises Institute for Austrian Economics, and we're talking about capitalism and how it's great, and actually how government is the problem. In fact, sir, you've written that hope lies not in the political process, but in convincing people that the political process is the source of our problems.
Absolutely. I think that is the correct way to view it, 100%. The market economy is the source of, the source of solutions in the economy. That's where we get new advances, new productivity, new inventions, new ideas, new ways of doing things, new medicines, new ways of producing clothing, housing, safety devices, etc. Where the government sector is constantly causing problems, and you know, there's a lot of mystique about government. It seems to be something that protects us and so on. But all of the advantages that it supposedly government produces ultimately is found to be problematic. I mean, there's a lot of examples out of there. For example, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government guaranteed mortgage companies that were, you know, supposed to be, oh, this creates more home ownership, according to Alan Greenspan, and, you know, this makes getting a home easier and so on and so forth. Well, now what we're finding out is that this company has finally grown up over the years. It's taken on huge liabilities, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars. And now we find that this government-created corporation is undertaking all sorts of corrupt practices. They've not maintained their capital base. They've been putting a lot of risk basically onto the taxpayers. And if things continue to deteriorate, all of these government-created mortgage-guaranteed corporations, the taxpayer could be liable for trillions of dollars of new debts. So instead of, you know, being the glorious progenitor of home ownership, they could be ultimately something that causes severe destruction in our economy. So, you know, every time they come up with an example of how great government is, ultimately what we find out is that it's a disaster waiting to happen. They said that only the government could be in charge of space flight and, you know, taking us to the moon and into upper space and so on and so forth. Well, what we found out recently with the XPRIZE competition is that a small number of people working with very simple technology can actually go up into space at a teeny, teeny fraction of what the government has been wasting and spending and diverting for decades and decades in keeping the private sector out of space rather than at the forefront of space exploration and the use, the productive use of space.
Do you worry about people seeing you as perhaps just an apologist for big business, that government is the only thing that we, the people, can do to restrain the billionaires from taking everything we have, and that in all the libertarian pressure against the power of the state to regulate business, that we make it just easier for big business?
No, well, we're not apologists for big business. At the Institute, we don't receive any money from either government or big corporations or special interest groups or large foundations. All of our money comes from individual members of the Institute, the small guy, the small businessman, the independent person. We don't get any funds from any of those groups. And what we say is untarnished, I think, by their influence in any way whatsoever. You know, so we don't get any support from them, and we don't advocate supporting their particular point of view. No one censors what I say or what I write at the Institute, and that's true for other Austrian economists as well, I think, by and large. We don't get largesse from either the government or big business. And in a lot of cases, we attack the influence of big business in government, as I said before. You know, the central bank is one of our main targets. And the central bank, the Federal Reserve System in our country, is basically a tool of big business. It's the big banks and the big corporations and how they take advantage of the little guy through the banking system. Now, let's just take a little example of what the Fed has been doing in terms of holding down interest rates while at the same time causing inflation. The little guy got 2%, his money in the savings account is making 2%. Prices are going up more than 3%. So the little guy is losing money. How's he going to get ahead when he's losing money on his savings? Where the big guy with $1 million in stocks, who puts it in a margin account, so he's really got controlling $2 million in stocks, they're going up at 18, 20% a year. So he's making 40% on his money. So
that's very interesting, because I think the common myth wouldn't the common myth be that inflation is good for the little guy who's in debt and it's bad for the rich people?
Well, no, it's the rich people who are getting all the debt. You know, my old saying in banking is you have to have money in order to get money from the banks.
Right. Okay. Well, we're up against the time wall here. We'll be right back after this break. It's the Republic Broadcasting Network. We're talking with Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute for Austrian Economics. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest is Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. His website is Mises.org, and also he writes columns with a little more political flavor at LouRockwell.com. And it should be remembered, ladies and gentlemen, that in 1776, when Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, which is the ideological foundation of free market capitalism, he wasn't refuting socialism. Socialism hadn't been invented yet. He was refuting mercantilism. What is mercantilism, Mr. Thornton?
Well, mercantilism, even though Adam Smith did a good refutation of it, is still alive and well. Mercantilism is basically an economic philosophy that supports big business. It's the traditional economic philosophy of the Republican Party. They don't like to admit that. They'd like to you know, show themselves as more of a Phil Graham type or a Richard Army type of Republican. But basically, by and large, the Republican Party is mercantilist, and they believe in subsidies for big business. They believe in public works projects for big business. They believe in protectionist policies to protect big business from international trade, and they believe in a monetary policy of inflation and government debt, again, which all seems to help the interests of big business. And so they are the ones that support the central bank, going back to Alexander Hamilton's time, who liked, you know, paper money, who liked instead of gold, and who liked the national debt. And of course, George Bush, the Republicans passed protectionist policies during the last 4 years to protect the steel industry and to protect the lumber industry and so on. And they have a long history, going back to the very foundation of this country, of wanting protectionist policies to help big business. And so if we look at subsidies for big business, if we look at public works programs for big business, it's kind of funny that, you know, the Republicans are sort of anti-environmental regulation. But when it comes to a big contract to be given away to some construction company to clean up some site that's been environmentally damaged, they're all for that. They're all for spending, you know, how many ever zillions of dollars to give away a government contract to some private company to clean something up or to build something that, you know, that has to do with the EPA. And so they love giving away these big contracts, whether it's Halliburton or whoever it is. And so their policy right down the line is something that supports big business to the detriment of small business and to the detriment of consumers and to the detriment of the average worker in the economy. And this is a philosophy that the Republican Party has today. It's always had that philosophy, and it goes back to the foundation of the Republican Party in the 1850s and to their successor party, the Whig Party, in the first half of the 19th century. And so that's basically mercantilism. And what Adam Smith refuted, he was correct. I mean, that it didn't make any sense to provide special subsidies, that it didn't make any sense for fiscal responsibility to issue paper money and for the government to go into big debt and for the government to be running, you know, industries and that kind of thing. And he refuted it, but that doesn't mean that a good idea doesn't necessarily stop special interests from pursuing their goals. And I think the American people need to be alerted to that effect and to wake up to the fact that the Republican Party is not a free market party that supports the interests of everyone in the economy, but that they weigh their interest in the direction of special interest groups, particularly big corporations.
Well, you alluded to the Federal Reserve as that amalgam of, I believe you called it, the tool of big business. And in fact, your name is on the back of The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. And when someone says mercantilism, I guess the Federal Reserve is the first thing that pops into my mind. It's the perfect amalgam of private and public interests and control over the money supply, right?
Yeah, this is a typical way of doing things, is where you have a sort of semi-private, you know, outside the direct physical control of government corporation, yet it's controlled and influenced by government in certain directions, certain political directions, certain political orientations.
Well, right, and its policies are backed up by police power.
Oh, right? Yes.
They set a rate. It's set.
It's absolutely set, and, you know, whereas if you ask a Republican about price controls, they would say, oh, well, price controls don't work, you know, they're stupid. But when it comes to the most important price in the economy, which is the interest rate, it's the thing that really directs the whole macro economy, savings, investing, entrepreneurship, and so forth, they're all for that, Democrats and Republicans. They love, you know, the fact that the Federal Reserve is controlling that interest rate and setting those policies and you know, of course, backing them up with the most powerful organization in the world outside of the U.S. military, and they probably got them in their pocket as well. So It's a very powerful group, and their influence on the interest rate, you know, we don't feel it as we're driving down the street. We don't feel it as we're walking into the mini mart or the grocery store or the department store. But believe you me, that central bank is the most powerful, the most disturbing and destructive organization in our economy. They are destroying the savings of Americans. They're destroying the real capital stock, and they're helping the federal government by going into all sorts of debt. And, of course, they're passing a new increase in the debt ceiling. That really is at the heart of all of that destruction. And the destruction of our future is right there at the central bank. And, of course, now, at the same time, while I'm talking about the destruction of us, it's helping a certain limited number of people make all sorts of money. So it's helping the banks, and it's helping the federal government go into more debt, and those sorts of things. So it's helping certain people, but it's ultimately having a disruptive effect on the overall economy.
Okay, well, I want to outline three different solutions to this problem, and I'm sure there's more. But among libertarian critics, these are the three different solutions in the most concrete way that I know about them. Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, his big problem is the private influence on the bank, and says that the Treasury Department should control it, and it should have 100% gold standard, no fractional reserve rate, and it should just be run by government, and police power should define a dollar as this many grains of silver or this many grains of gold. Then you have Harry Brown. Now, Harry Brown's big problem is not so much the private influence as it is the fact that it's government. And he says that fiat money's fine as long as it's private, and as long as you sign a contract and you know what their fractional reserve rate is, then fine. And all we really need to do is just completely privatize the currency. And then there's another gold expert and monetary historian by the name of Andrew Goss, who I've interviewed. And Andrew Goss has a solution, which he says, let's just nationalize the Federal Reserve and take all the private interests out of it, and let's just repeal all federal taxes in the entire country, repeal all the tariffs, repeal the 16th Amendment and all of that, and run the entire country, or run the entire national government off of inflation. Just let them print all their money every year, and then at least we all know where it comes from. So if you had to choose between those three choices, which would you choose, or do you have a better solution of your own?
Well, if that was a game show and it was door number one, door number two, and door number three, I would probably pick door number one, but I'd be willing to accept door number two, and I would be horrified by door number three.
Well, door number three at least abolishes the IRS, right?
Well, I mean, it certainly has an upside to it, but, you know, the effect of inflation on an economy is the most detrimental form of government finance, and it's the way in which government grows fastest, because it's a hidden tax, and people don't know they're being taxed, and people don't understand the disruptive effects and the distortion effects that inflation causes. So ultimately, an inflationary regime would be, although it would be great on day one, would deteriorate into chaos and destruction and a total breakdown of the market economy. So we would end up in a hyperinflation and destruction. So it would be, you know, better on day one. I would admit that, but ultimately it would end up in the toilet. So
what about Harry Brown's solution about go ahead and have fiat money, but just make it all private?
Well, you know, there's a lot to be said for a free banking system where the money is based on gold and silver, but banks are free to issue paper notes based on their reserves. In a free banking system, they wouldn't have to necessarily hold 100% reserves so that the banks could expand and contract the money supply. Now, this type of money and banking system is pretty darn good, and it's what we had in antebellum America when there was no federal regulation of banking. There was very little state regulation of banking. There was no federal paper money. There was very little state paper money. And the banks were basically on their own. They weren't regulated. They weren't supported. They weren't backed up. And so they couldn't really issue too much paper beyond what they held in gold and silver. So that was a pretty good system. The American economy experienced its highest rates of economic growth during that period. We had massive immigration. We had massive technological advance. We sent railroads and canals across the country. We developed an agricultural economy, international trade, and a manufacturing economy. And so we were very technologically growth. We had productivity growth. We had higher wages. It was a very good economy. The problem was is that there were lots of business cycles during that period where you where the banking system would get a little government support and get out of control. They would pump up the money supply, and there would be an overexpansion.
But it was the government support that had them overexpand the money?
Yeah, there were some funny dealings with the First Bank of the United States. There was a boom and a bust, and then that went out of business, and then they put in the Second Bank of the United States, and there was a big boom and a big bust associated with that. And then the third wave, there were state banks.
Well, to hear Griffin tell it in The Creature from Jekyll Island, when Andrew Jackson waged his war against the Second Bank of the United States, or maybe it was the third by then, I forget. But in order to defeat the bank and Nicholas Biddle, he had to join forces with the Wildcatters. And so they defeated the central bank, but to hear Griffin tell it that the battle was actually really lost in the end, because instead of having hard money like Jackson wanted, what we ended up with was no restrictions whatsoever on the amount of money that banks could create out of nothing, whereas Nicholas Biddle at least held the rein on them a little bit, how the Wildcatters went completely crazy and inflated the money supply to such degrees that it caused disasters.
Yes, there was a compromise with Jackson's battle against the banks, and we ended up, the best possible scenario is to end up with a free banking system that is checked by legal controls, and the most important legal control is the anti-fraud provision for 100% reserve banking. So if you have a deposit account, your money is actually remains on deposit. And if you have a time account, you get interest in exchange for the fact that the bank is going to lend your money out. And that's what most Austrians would like to see. A lot of Austrians are satisfied with a free banking scenario where banks can do whatever they want. And it's a pretty good system, as I just explained in the antebellum period.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other Austrians want the 100% reserve option where banks are controlled by the legal system, anti-fraud system, and which prevents banks from overexpanding the money supply by lending out money that is in somebody's demand deposit or checking account. And so we would definitely like to see a monetary system and a banking system based on gold and silver coins where banks are prevented from issuing paper that they are also telling other people that they can come in and get the money at any time. So we don't want the banks to have that ability to issue extra paper money.
All right, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And my friend Shauna is calling in with a question for you, sir, if that's okay.
Fine.
All right, Shauna, welcome to the show. You have a question for Mr. Thornton?
Yes, I have two questions, actually. One, a friend of mine recently suggested that we went off of the gold standard because Mexico has more gold under the ground than we do, and therefore they would have been the world economic power rather than us. And so is that true? Is it he who has the most gold under the ground is automatically the richest nation on earth? And number two, I noticed that in the market as we experience it today, it's more profitable to medicate people over a long term than it is to prevent or, provide quick cures to diseases. And under a free market, would we see an improvement in that?
Two very good questions. Mr. Thornton?
Very good question, Shauna. In terms of the gold standard, the U.S. went off the gold standard in 1971. It wasn't the real gold standard. It was only a gold standard between banks where the U.S. guaranteed other central banks that they could exchange 35 paper dollars, U.S. paper dollars, for an ounce of gold. And basically what we had done during the 50s, but particularly the 1960s, when we were fighting the Vietnam War and the War on Poverty, and the government was spending too much money, we were issuing too much paper money. The central banks from around the world basically caught on to us and started asking to redeem our paper dollars at our central bank for gold. And President Nixon realized that there was way too much paper money out there to redeem based on the amount of gold we had. So he just shut the gold window and took us off the gold standard and put the world on a fiat monetary system where paper is not backed by gold and silver. And some people still believe that our money is backed by gold and silver, but it really isn't. We've been taken off of that system. We don't have any silver coins. You can't exchange your paper money for gold. And central banks can't even do that. So we went off of it because of the fact that our government was spending too much money, was at war, had a warfare state, had a welfare state, and it couldn't continue that. You know, that's the thing about these policies is that ultimately they cannot continue for an indefinite period of time. And so we ended up going off the gold standard. I don't think it had anything to do with Mexico in particular. The amount of gold money in an economy really doesn't matter.
Okay, well, we're up against the break here. We're going to come right back and answer that question about medicine and long-term treatment.
I'll hang up now, okay?
Thank you, Shauna, for your call. It's a weekend interview show, everybody. Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute is the guest, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. If anybody wants to listen to the archives of this or any other of the interviews that I've done, weekendinterviewshow.com. My guest this hour is Mark Thornton, and his website is Mises.org. He's from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and he also writes more political columns for LouRockwell.com. I highly recommend reading his articles. They're very interesting. And, sir, the show's almost over, so I want to give you an opportunity to address Shauna's question about medicine, but I want you to hurry because I got one more thing I want to ask you about. Her question was, for folks just tuning in, she said that lately there's been a trend in medicine that it's more profitable to treat people and their illnesses over the long term rather than curing them and sending them home. And her question for Mr. Thornton was, would he expect this to get worse or to be solved if we were to have a free market in medicine, sir?
I think healthcare would get tremendously much better in a free market scenario. You've got to remember that right now, government gives doctors a monopoly on their profession. That drives up price and decreases quantity. You've got to remember that government controls almost all of the hospitals, either through financing or through direct ownership. That raises the price and reduces the quality. And you've got to remember that government provides a tax-free benefit for health insurance, and that's comprehensive health insurance, so that if you've got it, you can get anything you want basically for free or with a small deductible, so you can go in there and spend however much money you want because the insurance company's going to pay. That increases the price and increases the demand on healthcare services. But if you're outside the system, if you don't have this comprehensive health care, what you face is a tremendous increase in price and almost no access to quantity. So you've got a system that is totally junked up by government, and it's totally been geared towards things like surgery and things like prescriptions and things of that nature, and almost no emphasis whatsoever placed on preventive care. And so when the government is there to provide you with hospitals and doctors and welfare medical coverage, Medicaid, Medicare, and so on and so forth, people do not have the incentive to seek out and to pay for preventive health, whether that's exercise, whether that's proper diet, whether that's taking supplements, whether that's getting tested when necessary. So we have a system that is geared away from preventive health care and towards the most expensive type of health care, where everybody has a monopoly and the government is managing the efficiency of the operation. So if the free market were let back in, the health care would be more preventative, it would be of a higher quality, and it would be at a cost where everybody could afford it.
All right. Good answer as far as I can tell. All right, now, last question here in the last couple of minutes we have. I love the articles that you wrote about Star Wars and about how the story of Episode 1, 2, and 3, the new prequels of the Star Wars trilogy, is the story of a mercantilist state and big government in a republic that drives itself all the way into becoming an evil empire. And what a wonderful analogy that is for our times.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. It's a lot of fun to look at these analogies in fiction and in fact, and we see them all the time. And the key to the success of Star Wars is that the writer, director, producer is drawing from our historical experience. So he's putting these images, you know, from our past of the British Empire and of mercantilism and taxes and colonies and slavery and war and tariffs and all that kind of stuff. And he's building them into the story about the future with hairy beasts and little munchkins and craft and all this kind of stuff. So he's really, his success is that he's drawn from our experience, and what he shows in Star Wars is that a peaceful Republican
All right, that's it. Goodbye.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Mark.